The Yemeni army says it has made fresh gains in the central province of Al Baida, liberating more districts from Saudi-backed militants. Taliban say there is no ceasefire agreement with the Afghan government today after three more provincial capitals fall to the militant group. And also in the headlines, a senior aide to the New York governor resigns amid a sexual harassment scandal involving Andrew Cuomo. This is World News from Tehran with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting off with Yemen, the army and allied Nasrallah fighters have made fresh gains in the central province of Al Baida, liberating two more districts from Saudi-backed militants. The spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces said the two districts were taken during an operation to liberate the entire province. Yahya Saria says the forces are in the process of clearing out the remaining pockets in Baida. The Yemeni army launched an operation called Nasr al-Mubin last week. It's continued advancing since then. It's inching closer to Bayhan town in Shabwa province. That's strategically near the border with Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. Scores of Daesh and Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists have been killed in the operation. Now, in the meantime, Yemeni people have taken to the streets of the capital Sana'a to protest the Saudi blockade of their country that's deteriorating their economic condition day after day. In Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali has the story.
Under the title, The Blockade and Raising Customs Tariffs is an American Crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Hadi government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden Port amid the continued closure of Hodeida Port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders, militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities. And this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender. But our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
People here say that Washington is backing the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation in the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Spokesman for the Taliban says there is no agreement on a ceasefire with the Afghan government. The Taliban's political office also warned against further U.S. intervention in the country. Meantime, the militants have captured another provincial capital as government forces are trying to halt the group's rapid advances. The militants reportedly seized the city of Talagan, the capital of Takhar province. That's the fifth provincial capital that the Taliban have seized in 2 days. On Sunday, they took over the cities of Sarapol and Kunduz. Afghan officials say that heavy fighting still rages in Kunduz. attacked our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, just an hour ago. He says African troops have pushed back the Taliban in the capital of Badakhshan province.
The capital of Badakhshan, Faizabad, is also currently the scene of fighting between Afghan troops and Taliban militants. Afghan military commanders in Faizabad, the capital of northeastern Badakhshan province, say that Afghan troops have pushed back Taliban attack from inside the city, and currently some fightings are underway between government troops backed by local armed forces and the Taliban in the outskirts of the city. Taliban has paid a special attention to Badakhshan because it connects Afghanistan with Tajikistan, with China, and with Pakistan.
Iran has slammed the remarks made by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible.
The remarks by the British Foreign Secretary against the Iranian nation are nothing new, and they are only a sample of the many irresponsible remarks that have been made in the past years by British officials. I seriously recommend the UK government to pay attention to its duties and responsibilities, and they should know that the security of the Persian Gulf is a red line for Iran.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh rejected the allegations as baseless, saying that blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Tel Aviv regime. He said the comments of EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran is committed to ensuring the security of the strategic Persian Gulf waterway in the Strait of Hormuz. The reaction came after G7 foreign ministers and EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell claimed that Iran was involved in last week's attack on an Israeli-managed vessel off the coast of Oman. Tel Aviv said it's ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move. Israeli soldiers have clashed with Palestinian protesters near the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces used tear gas and fired rubber bullets against protesters who responded by hurling stones. Protesters in the town of Beita demand that Israeli authorities hand over the body of Shadi al-Sharfa, who was killed by Israeli soldiers in July. They also voiced anger at a settlement outpost, which was illegally constructed near Beita. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories for months over settlement activity, as well as a planned eviction of Palestinian families from their ancestral homes. In the meantime, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have to stage a rally before the Red Cross office to announce the start of an international campaign to back Palestinian prisoners. The protest brings to the spotlight the condition of Palestinian detainees, especially those under the illegal administrative detention. Ruba Shabbat reports.
The Prisoners Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge, and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer, and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
A senior aide to the New York governor has resigned amid a sexual harassment scandal involving Andrew Cuomo. Secretary to the governor quit after a state attorney general's report linked her in efforts to cover up the case and retaliate against one of the accusers. The report says Cuomo sexually harassed 11 former and current women employees. It prompted local prosecutors to launch a criminal investigation amid calls for the governor to resign or be impeached. Cuomo has so far resisted the calls from fellow Democrats, including President Joe Biden, to step down. The 63-year-old Democrat has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing or ever touching a woman inappropriately. He's acknowledged that his efforts to be affectionate with people he encounters may have made some people feel uncomfortable. A top U.S. health official says that his country is failing in its fight against the COVID-19 outbreak.
Well, I'm afraid we should not really have ever gotten in the place we are. So in that regard, yes, we are failing. We have vaccines that we know are highly effective and safe, and yet half the country is still not fully vaccinated, and about 90 million people have not even gotten one dose. We would
not be in right. Francis Collins says that the U.S. Wouldn't see a new hike in the number of cases and deaths if it had vaccinated more people. Now, those comments were made as the country has logged 118,000 new daily infections, its highest tally since February. Deaths from the respiratory disease have also soared by nearly 90% in the past 2 weeks. The surge is blamed on the highly infectious Delta strain. The world's worst nation has reported nearly 617,000 deaths and over 35.7 million cases. Well, that was the situation in the U.S. Now let's take a look at France. The country is extending its controversial COVID health pass system to more routine activities despite nationwide protests. The measure requires the people to show a health pass to enter cafes, restaurants, and shopping malls. They will also need a pass for traveling on intercity trains. The pass system shows one has been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, has tested negative, or has recently recovered. It's already been required since July 21st to visit cultural venues across the country. The extension was approved on Thursday despite weeks of protests which called the rule against civil liberties. Authorities insist the scheme is necessary to stop the spread of the coronavirus in the country. France has recorded over 6.2 million COVID cases. Now let's go to French capital Paris. We have Chris Van Hoon there. Chris, good to have you with us. Hopefully you're keeping safe from all of this. So tell us about this health pass thing. Looks like the French people are divided. I mean, they know that the virus is taking their lives. Still, some of them are raising this individual liberty and that stuff. So what's going on there?
Well, the French government has taken more restrictive measures because only 50% of the French population has been vaccinated twice, and that's not enough to hold back the virus, and especially the Delta variant. So if people would be convinced by the medical facts that they should be vaccinated in order to prevent a new lockdown and a new curfew, there would be no health pass necessary. But the French government, and it has been approved by the Senate and by the Parliament and by the Constitutional Council, consider that in order to obtain 60-70% of the population vaccinated twice, they need to push them a little bit. So they ordered this health pass, and people, if they go to restaurants and to smaller places, not big places, smaller places, even there they have to show that electronic document to prove that they are vaccinated or a negative PCR test. Now, I spoke to a lot of people this weekend, amongst them protesters against the health pass, but also people who visited public places and who are rather in favor of the health pass. So you have really two blocks in France today. And amongst the protesters, I feel that they are more and more convinced that vaccination is sufficient against the virus, but they are more against the mandatory health pass. So if you argue with them saying that if you don't push the French a little bit in order to get vaccinated, you will have other restrictive measures like the lockdown and the curfew. So they have not really arguments for that, but which is really amazing that it's many people have demonstrated this weekend in the middle of the holiday season in Paris, but also in the south of France. So the protests remain important, and people consider that as a violation of their individual liberty. Now, where does individual liberty stops and where does public liberties start? Because it's medically proven that people who are vaccinated or areas that are vaccinated largely, the Delta variant does not cause severe symptoms amongst the vaccinated people, and especially people do not die as it happens amongst non-vaccinated people. That's important.
So, Chris, can you give me an idea of, is it the bulk of people who are against this health pass and restrictions, or the minority?
About the vaccination, it's a small minority who is against the vaccination. About the health pass, there is an evolution in the discussion. Some weeks ago, people said, we don't know about the vaccination. Today, they cannot say that they don't know about the vaccination. Medical facts prove that vaccination is efficient. So it's more... It's difficult to say minority and majority. I feel amongst my own friends or people I know, it's really half-half, and people are like discussing very severely about against or in favor of that. So it's not a big majority against the health pass, that's for sure. Many people are in favor. So it's I think it's a silent majority in favor of the health pass.
Okay, thank you very much for that, and keep safe. Chris and Holmes in Paris. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, says Sasha Bromsky, journalist, in an article titled UK is embarking on largest military spending hike since Cold War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Late last year, with the pandemic in full, brutal swing, Boris Johnson's Conservative government in the UK announced a nearly £17 billion, what was then $21.9 billion increase in military spending. The increase spread over 4 years, represented the largest hike in defense investments since the end of the Cold War. And while it was a tiny fraction of what the U.S. spends annually on defense, made clear Britain's ambition to be seen as a global military superpower once more. In an era of escalating tensions between a U.S.-led NATO and Russia, and during a period in which economic competition between China and the West is increasingly morphing into a high-stakes arms race, Britain's move to ramp up military spending made clear that the UK won't be sitting out these new global struggles. In fact, the UK decision to escalate military investments was based on an evolving military doctrine of constant competition with adversaries that would keep opponents off balance, while hopefully staying just clear of provocations that could lead to war. The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons. In March, the government announced it would raise the cap on the number of warheads the country possessed by a staggering 40%. And that it would no longer make public the number of operational nuclear weapons that it controlled. Critics argued to no avail that this would undermine the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which Britain is a signatory. Folded into the new, more aggressive military posture were changes that went far beyond the nuclear arsenal. Johnson's government unveiled plans for advanced new naval systems, set up a new space command, and committed to large investments in futuristic artificial intelligence. As a part of this new posture in which post-Brexit Britain isolated from its half-century-long relationship to the EU, or what was formerly known as the European Economic Community, and the power brokers on the continent, takes on increasingly confrontational military policing roles globally and regionally. The UK recently sent an aircraft carrier and broader naval strike group into South China Sea. The vessels, part of an international effort ostensibly designed to preserve freedom of navigation in contested international waters, sailed between Singapore and the Philippines, deliberately coming within a few miles of contested islands claimed by China in the region. This follows on the heels of another venture in which the UK sent a Navy strike force into the waters off Crimea, territory annexed by Russia in 2014. One can well make the baseless claim that both Russia and China are taking deeply irresponsible actions on the world stage. Yet, acceptance of that critique is different from acceptance of the desirability of giving Boris Johnson's government carte blanche to launch whatever military adventures it chooses to embark upon. In fact, Johnson's government, seeking to shore up its right-wing populist credentials, seems now to want to reach for military solutions even against recent allies. This spring, in one of the stranger post-Brexit moments, The Brits began scrambling up naval vessels against French and other EU fishers in the English Channel. The vessels were rushed off to the island of Jersey and were apparently aimed at breaking a blockade of the local waters by fishers from the continent. Irate that their long-standing right to fish these waters had now been terminated. In the end, both sides stood down, but the very notion that the UK and France could come to the edge of a naval confrontation over fishing rights, with the British government egged on by a snarling, far-right, flag-worshipping tabloid press, is simply astounding and shows exactly how far Britain has veered off course since the Brexit of 2016 set in motion the years-long process of divorce between the UK and its erstwhile partners within the European Union. French fishing vessels haven't been the only targets of the British military in the seas abutting Britain. For much of the past year, as Johnson's government has ramped up its rhetorical and legal campaigns against asylum seekers, ultra-sophisticated military drones have patrolled British waters, looking for migrants desperately trying to enter the country's waters on rafts. The arms build up, and Britain's growing willingness to needle opponents militarily is, to say the least, disconcerting. Yet, it isn't exactly a development out of the blue. For while Britain has, for most of its modern history, steered clear of maintaining large standing armies during peacetime, it hasn't hesitated to use its naval assets to secure global influence. In fact, in many ways, the UK's new doctrine of constant competition and ongoing military assertiveness is a souped-up version of a mid-19th century imperial doctrine, gunboat diplomacy, perfected by statesmen such as Lord Palmerston as a way to realize British ambitions around the world without actually triggering war with the other behemoth on the global stage. Palmerston was a master of the art of military populism. He routinely sent gunboats to potential flashpoints while talking about the military muscle flexing as simply being a defense of British values of liberty, democracy, and freedom. The press and much of the British public relished these shows of force, and for many years, Palmerston bestrode the halls of Westminster, first as Foreign Secretary and then as Prime Minister. He relied on Britain's raw power to impose his views, but, as importantly, he relied on bluster, in the sense that he was just gung-ho enough, just trigger-happy enough to follow through on his threats, to convince opponents that ceding to Britain would serve their interest better than forcing an actual fight. Today, Johnson is reimagining British diplomacy in a similar way. His government pledged to cut international aid from 0.7% of the gross national income to 0.5%, and recently won a parliamentary vote on the issue, despite former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May joining with a group of rebel members of Parliament to vote against Johnson's plan. Yet, even as his government slashes overseas aid in a cruel effort to balance a budget-falling stimulus measures designed to counter the economic impact of the pandemic, it increases military spending. Britain is now the only G7 country cutting rather than increasing its international aid commitments. It is, at the same time, spending more on its military than any other G7 member, apart from the United States, making it the fifth highest military spender on the planet. In 2020, Germany spent 1.4% of its GDP on its military, and France itself, in the middle of a significant military build-up, spent 2.1%. Britain, by contrast, spent 2.2%. This combination of withdrawal from non-military international obligations and high-profile military spending speaks volumes for the priorities of post-Brexit Britain. Moreover, it speaks volumes about the values underpinning Johnson's particularly noxious brand of right-wing nationalistic populism. This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, after 20 years of Afghanistan being occupied by the United States, Afghanis as well as neighboring countries continue to call for Afghan unity and security in that nation, something they have not had since its occupation. Well, the Taliban are on the move and have taken control of three provincial capitals in just one day. What does the future hold for Afghanistan? Is this Taliban the same as those 20 years ago? And did Washington create a scenario to create more tension and chaos in the country? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
The Afghan Defense Ministry has confirmed the fall of Shibir Khan, Kunduz and Saripul cities in northern Afghanistan into the hands of the Taliban, saying Afghan troops backed by local armed forces have retreated as an attempt to avoid civilian casualties.
In the meantime, the Defense Ministry also says that government troops backed by local armed forces are planning to conduct a large-scale attack on the captured cities to retake them from the Taliban. A move that, according to military commanders, needs more time.
In such circumstances, locals here look to the ongoing war as unfruitful. They urge the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the rest of local players to set aside their differences for the sake of people's demand, which is peace and calm.
None of the foreign players can bring a lasting peace to Afghanistan in the absence of a strong unity among us. Especially among main players such as the government and the Taliban. They must set aside their differences and work for the sake of people while not relying on foreigners, mainly the US.
Many others also believe that there are some secret dealings behind the recent rising Taliban advances. That is why they want some international bodies, mainly the UN, to intervene in an effort to end what they call a proxy war in Afghanistan.
We, the people of Afghanistan, have realized that there are some dirty foreign hands involved in the rising war and bloodshed in our country. That's why we call on the United Nations to intervene and convince the backers of the conflict to stop their proxy wars in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has expanded its attacks over the recent month, capturing over 200 districts in different parts of the country. The militants are gaining more ground despite suffering heavy casualties during their assaults, mainly on big cities. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the spotlight, Christoph Horstel, political activist and veteran journalist out of Berlin. And Daniel Lazar, journalist and author out of New York. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start off in Berlin. And Christoph, I mean, what has Washington been doing in Afghanistan for 20 years that when it announces it is leaving, Afghan forces who they have trained appear not to be able to prevent cities from falling in the hands of the Taliban? What did the U.S. accomplish in the country?
Well, that's the big question, next to nothing, as they have the officials all over NATO telling us this now, right now. I have said that a dozen years ago when I wrote my first book on Afghanistan, and we have a very good institution in the U.S. which is called SIGAR, Special Inspector General on Afghanistan Recovery. And they have made, a whole study costing dozens of millions of dollars, amounting to exactly what I have predicted in 2007. There's a zero outcome for the U.S. They will spill a lot of blood. They will spend a lot of money, billions. And, of course, they will achieve nothing in Afghanistan because you cannot, you know, be successful if you come armed. If you come as a friend, it's fantastic. That is what I did all the time in the last 35 years. And that was a very good experience, especially also with the Taliban, where I enjoyed friendships, but also, of course, there are people I cannot talk to. That is, the range of personalities within the Taliban.
Well, Daniel, I mean, your assessment of what is happening in Afghanistan right now, and as an American, aren't you just frustrated with your government for getting involved in this to begin with and spending all this money and basically accomplishing nothing?
Well, yes. I mean, the American government is amazingly incompetent. And remember, Joe Biden was a very early cheerleader of this war. He was one of the most enthusiastic voices in favor of it back in 2001. But the U.S. went in for very ill-considered reasons. It claimed to want to destroy al-Qaeda. But it let Osama bin Laden slip through his fingers when they had him cornered in Tora Bora near the Pakistani border. And the U.S. poured trillions actually, into that country. But the only effect was to raise corruption to absolutely unheard-of levels. So now the country is weaker than ever. And the post-American regime is collapsing faster than the post-Soviet regime did back in 1992. So it's really the post-Soviet regime lasted 3 years, whereas the current regime is lasting barely 3 months. It's really astonishing. The country is weak. It's fragmented. It has no sense of self-confidence or legitimacy, and it's crumbling at a rapid rate. As the Taliban advance proceeds.
Well, Christoph, you said that you have gone to Afghanistan several times and spent time there. Let's talk about that, because is the Taliban today different from the Taliban of 20 years ago?
Yes, of course they are. There are, of course, a lot of the leaders which are still in charge. That is clear. But there are very tough lessons which the Taliban had to learn back in 2001. And I think they have learned them. Of course, you know, this is Afghanistan. This is a very, very poor country. Still, we have more than 80 or 85% illiteracy in this country. And that is something you cannot overcome so quickly. And of course, there is no administration to be fixed that quickly that will make Afghanistan one of the, I would say, usual countries. So Afghanistan is special, will remain special for a lot of time. But of course, now you can talk to the Taliban. That is something interesting. Donald Trump has tried it with his people. He tried quite well. And it was, by the way, in 2007 that the German Chancellor wrote to me and they said, the suggestions you made in your book will be heeded. I was very angry to hear that because my idea was that we very quickly arrange a withdrawal from Afghanistan with all our bloody NATO troops. They have lost nothing there. They have no reason to stay there. All the stories were wrong. The CIA did 9/11 themselves and things like that. And now I see how quickly that crumbles. I have predicted that there's no stability in Afghanistan, which we could have, NATO or the US or Germany could have installed there. That's the story. The Taliban have learned their lessons, and we will find out in the next months and years how deeply they have learned them and if there's a coherence within the Taliban, both regionally and politically. That's a very interesting question, and nobody, I think, can answer that right now. And I think the US will do their usual dirty game with their dollar bags and try to, you know, raise trouble in the area.
Well, Daniel, there are some analysts as well as regular Afghan civilians that are saying that the U.S. made a deal with the Taliban and that government forces in many areas are simply pulling back and allowing the Taliban to take over. Your take of this analysis?
I'm not aware of any deal. I'd be very surprised if there was. It's possible, I suppose, but there's no evidence that I've seen in favor of it. I want to stress one thing. The CIA did not cause 9/11. 9/11 was caused by Al-Qaeda with apparently significant backing by certain elements of the Saudi government. It had nothing to do with the CIA. And I also assume the Taliban, I have no reason to disbelieve this, but I assume the Taliban is the same profoundly reactionary force it was back in 2001. And so therefore the outlook for Afghanistan is extremely grim. The U.S. has made things worse, but I'm not convinced the Taliban will make anything better.
What about that, Christoph, what Daniel was saying is basically the prognosis in Afghanistan is very dim. Your take on that, because you said that there has been a transition between the Taliban of today and 20 years ago.
That's some kind of prophecy which is being raised from a country which is doing its level best let chaos stay within Afghanistan, because there's a very simple question at hand. What happens to the U.S. if Iran and China shake hands and build a double pipeline of oil and gas between the two countries and maybe even include India into the deal? That would be terrible for Washington. That's their greatest nightmare. And therefore, they think the only chance they got is to make Afghanistan so crazy that no pipeline will ever stay in this country. So this is the real business behind all this big talk. And I think the Taliban are now quite able to, maintain as much calm if the U.S. is not disturbing them too much to have that pipeline realized, and that would be something fantastic.
So you're saying, Christoph, that the United States wants chaos to reign basically in Afghanistan?
Of course they want to do that. They have done it in the past. They will try to do that now, and they will use their bloody dollar bags to achieve that. I have seen their officers run around with these plastic bags filled with bundles of $100 notes, and that is the business going on. It will continue. Of course they have some friends among the Taliban, but they have some friends among all the factions and fractions of political life in Afghanistan. But not to be in touch with the Taliban, of course, would be very bad for all of Washington's goals in this country.
What about that, Daniel? Do you think that the U.S. had a plan to expand the chaos there, as it definitely knew the capabilities of both the Afghan army as well as the Taliban?
Well, The U.S. has created chaos. There's no question about that. But the U.S. has no plans. The U.S. has no plan. It's an irrational force, a nihilistic force that has no idea what to do, and it certainly has no idea what to do now after its 20-year effort in Afghanistan is crumbling rapidly before its eyes. I mean, this is the greatest defeat the U.S. has experienced since Vietnam in 1975. It's a devastating blow. The U.S. is being shut out of all of Central America, which is now apparently in the hands of Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, and Pakistan. But the U.S. is nowhere to be seen. It's a devastating strategic setback. And the idea that somehow the U.S. is still in control, is still directing things behind the scenes, I mean, that's just ridiculous. The U.S. is, the U.S. is at a loss of what to do. It has met with profound failure in that country, and Afghanistan will wind up worse, not better, as a consequence.
What do you think, Christoph? I mean, the U.S. is still saying that it's going to use its B-52 bombers and it's going to support the Afghan forces. Do you agree with what Daniel said, or is there a plan by Washington in what it's doing and what it has done now?
Well, certainly Washington has plans for each and every corner of this world. And it is very clear that their plan is, well, we cannot keep Afghanistan under our occupation all the time. It's simply too costly. And therefore, they go back to this, chaos plan, that if they can't rule it, if they can't use Afghanistan, if they are no longer the big winners from the huge heroin business, then, of course, it is necessary that they help create this chaos. This doesn't mean that they control the chaos. It just means they introduce it whenever needed, whenever there's too much or too strong order growing in Afghanistan. Then they will try to destroy it. Then they will try to create, problems between the people. That's a business they love and understand, and they keep Afghanistan away from development. And hopefully, of course, they can, pay some of the Taliban to kill some Iranians, as they have done in the past in Herat. Iran has been very able in the past to establish much better diplomacy with the Taliban in the recent years. But of course, this is nothing Washington is very happy about. So if we remember that before 2001, the plan in Washington was to encircle Iran and make sure that by occupying Iran, NATO would close, the big eastern Iranian part, and then they would simply need something in the north, which then utterly failed later on, to complete the circle around Iran. So this has completely failed. This strategy is dead, stone dead. But what they can do, of course, our American friends, unfortunately, is playing this chaos card. And that is something they are good at. They are doing it everywhere, whenever they cannot rule. And this is what will happen to Afghanistan in the time to come. And it will need a lot of, resolve and cooperation from the side of China and Pakistan and Iran, regional powers. Russia will be introducing itself into it and see whether they can, as regional forces, evict American chaos agents from that area.
Daniel, what does all of this mean for the Afghan government? As you're saying, post-Soviet when the Soviets departed, it took at least 3 years, but the situation seems to be moving quite rapidly. Your analysis of the Afghan government in all of this?
Well, the Afghan government has shown itself to be incredibly weak. I mean, far weaker than the government the Soviets left behind in 1989. It's really dramatic. This government is just crumbling in a matter of months. The Taliban advance is accelerating. The government has shown itself to be just so feeble, it's incredible. So as to what happens from this point out, I mean, I don't know. I assume that the Taliban will eventually march into Kabul, will install their reign of power from one end of the country to the other. The question is whether fighting breaks out between the Taliban and its fellow jihadis, the Al-Qaeda and ISIS, who have also established a major presence in the country. So whether ISIS, whether the Taliban can actually bring order is questionable, and whether this is simply the, you know, the opening stage in a new process of civil war is unknown.
Christoph, your analysis of that, what Daniel just said, whether the Taliban could bring stability and unity in that country.
They can do much better than it is now. That is quite clear. It remains to be seen how much simply the U.S. want to invest into chaos in Afghanistan. That's a question. There was a saying in the NATO occupation time in Afghanistan that you cannot buy Afghans, you can lease them. So there's some truth to this due to the terrible poverty in this country, which, of course, you know, the Western alliance wanted to remain, because as long as they are poor, wages are low. So that is the situation. They will try to maintain this. I think the Taliban leadership is very well aware of what happened in the past 30 years in Afghanistan, and they will find their ways to, you know, kick out chaos from Afghanistan as good as they can. They will take some time. It's easy to make this very weak and artificial government run away, but it's not so easy to establish order and to rule the country orderly. They have made progress, as I said, but I think it's not big enough to achieve order soon, and there will be a huge problem that a lot of those neighbors, Iran, Pakistan, and China, mostly China, I think, they will try to tell the Taliban what to do and what not to do, and that's the wrong way with the Taliban. This is what I can say. There are other ways to convince them, to win them, and then install something good, but unfortunately, policy usually does not strive for something good, but for some gains, and that makes it a very difficult business in Afghanistan, and that, in fact, is the biggest enemy of order.
Daniel, I mean, Iran is actually calling for the end to the occupation in Afghanistan, along with security and unity of the Afghan people. In your perspective, what would it take to reach those goals?
That's a very good question. I have no answer, actually. The Soviet Union went in 1979, late 79, with an attempt, with a very flawed program, but one that aimed to bring the country, into the modern world. And it was defeated by mainly U.S., Pakistani, Saudi imperialism, who armed the most bloodthirsty and reactionary elements in the country. And these bloodthirsty and reactionary elements are the ones who the U.S. then propelled back into power in 2001, when it invaded Afghanistan. And so no surprise, the government that the militias formed is weak and corrupt and fractious in the extreme. Now, Afghanistan is a broken country. It's been torn by 40 years of warfare. It's been devastated. What the outside world has done to it is one of the great crimes of the modern era. I doubt very much the Taliban can somehow repair the damage. I'm sure they will merely compound it. But putting Afghanistan back on its feet, introducing a note of economic development, providing for some kind of degree of a progressive social reforms, that will be extremely difficult in the years to come.
Okay, but of course, we're keeping our eyes on Afghanistan and fingers crossed. I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. I'm Berlin, Christoph Horstel, political activist and veteran journalist, and out of New York, Daniel Lizat, journalist and author. And as always, we appreciate you being with us here on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for staying with us, and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guests, Brother Ayman Rizvi and Ali Alevian. Assalamu alaikum to both of these dear guests.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, brother. So in the series of the program, Viewpoints, we are mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Khamenei. One important topic which has been tackled by him on different occasions and his speeches is the position of human being and how important it is in Islam. We know that Islam has a type of special and specific look at the position of human being as the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's why when we are talking about human, we are not talking about the humanistic approach, something which was maybe very much welcome in the Western world or secular world. We are talking about Islam, we are talking about Prophet Muhammad and the Ahlul Bayt's viewpoints regarding human beings. Imam Khamenei also, on different occasions, tackled this issue. Brother Ali Alevian, what's your take on that? We pay attention to, ahkam and aqaid, I mean the rulings, which are considered about what is halal, what is haram, how to do wajibat, okay, what are the beliefs in our system. But what about the akhlaqi part of the life of the human beings?
Yeah, actually spiritualities have an important role in our lives, and we cannot actually ignore their role in life in case we delete and remove and omit spirituality from our life. So nothing will exist from our, from our personality and a human being's personality, because human being is in need of a sort of, supplication, prayer with the Creator.
That's right.
So where are they discussed? They are discussed in actually akhlaqi sessions, akhlaqi meetings, and human beings are always in need of a person to guide them and advise them.
So one beautiful example. So regarding akhlaq, see how Imam Hussein alayhi salam behaved the army of the enemy on that time, not stopping them the water, that before reaching to Karbala, the army of the enemy reached the place, the